a little while ago, I did an episode on my favourite films on the Newton Talks Best Films of the 1990s, which was a very easy episode to record. I think the 90s was probably the best decade for cinema. There were plenty of films to choose from. I had lots of honourable mentions that just slipped outside of my top 20. And when I talked about recording the episode with colleagues and friends, they all seemed really excited because they all had numerous films that they loved from the 90s as well. When I came up with the idea to do one for the years 2000 to 2009, it seemed to be a much harder task. Just glancing through lists of the films that came out during the noughties didn't reveal many great movies. Nevertheless, I created a top 20 that I was quite happy with, and then just before recording it, a film came to mind that I'd completely forgotten about, and this was an all-time favourite of mine, and I forgot that it was released during the 2000s. And then, about a day after that, another film came to mind, then another, and it turned out that I'd forgotten to list in my top 20 about three of my all-time favourite films. So I postponed the recording, I did more research, and I suddenly started to remember all these other fantastic films that came out during the decade. My initial attitude towards the years 2000 to 2009 in cinema was actually quite poor, and I've rewritten my top 20 now that you're about to hear, and now I'm confident that this is the definitive Newton Talks best films of the 2000s. Or the noughties, depending on how you want to refer to that decade. Now, I remind listeners, this is very much the Newton Talks best film of the noughties. There's no Lord of the Rings. There's no Wong Kar Wai. You got no Batman films. No Slumdog Millionaire. But to balance out my prejudices, I've brought in Dr. Chris DC and Dr. Jennifer Wallace, two previous collaborators, to give me their favourite films of the decade. And we'll hear from them a little bit later on. So before we get into my top 20, let's go through some honourable mentions. These are all films I really enjoy that fall short of making that top list. Open Range, Apocalypto, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, Inglourious Bastards, 44-inch Chest, Assassination of Richard Nixon, Rise of the Foot Soldier, In the Loop, The Hangover, Whip It, Watchmen, Sexy Beast, Shaft, Snatch, The Business, The Lives of Others, Mulholland Drive, Martyrs, The House Bunny, Eastern Promises, Rambo, Zodiac, Hard Candy, Dawn of the Dead, Gangster Number One, Mike Bassett, England Manager, Rocky Balboa, A History of Violence, A Fish Tank, Brokeback Mountain, Sex Lives of the Potato Men, Gangs of New York, Biggie and Tupac, Way of the Gun, Old Boy, Quills, Freddy Got Fingered, From Hell, Maria Full of Grace, The Corporation, A Snake in June, The Woodsman, and Top Spot by Tracy Emin. So here is the Newton Talks top 20 films of the years 2000 to 2009. At number 20, I'm going for Fahrenheit 9/11 by Michael Moore. Now, this film's definitely of its time. I wonder whether I or anybody else will even watch this again. And I do take the point that there was a lot of criticism at the time for Moore's use of footage and how it could be considered manipulative or sometimes plain dishonest. But the film still works in the way it constructs an argument, in how funny it is, and how it pursues a really polemical line. I'm not totally sold on what it's trying to do, but Moore, I think, deserves credit here for reminding people that documentaries could be cinematic. How a documentary can be a real night out in the cinema or a film that you'd want to rent. At number 19, I've gone for Amer by Helene Cattet and Bruno Forzani in this homage to Gialli or the Giallo movies from the late 60s and into the 1970s by the likes of Mario Bava, Dario Argento and Sergio Martino. Amer focuses on three different stories. They all involve three stages of life of a single character. And the three sequences investigate the psychosexual incidents that have haunted her. It's got a really interesting shooting and cutting style that comes from Cattet and Forzani's early short films, which were made using still images, edited together into a story. And there's lots of gels over lights, entire sequences that are green or red or blue. And it's a cliche to say that this style is hallucinatory, but it's a good description of what they bring here. And they retain this style in their subsequent movies, in the most effective of which I think is Let the Corpses Tan from 2017. So Amer at number 19. At number 18, I've gone for the Canadian horror film Pontypool, which is a really original take on the zombie narrative. It's all set in a radio studio, so it's got a really good kind of chamber piece feel to it, where this shock jock style DJ is reacting to this sort of, but not really, zombie infection that's taking place around the world. But they're not really infected the way that we would assume zombies to be infected these days. That instead, people get hung up on certain words or phrases, and this causes them to attack others. Pontypool at number 18. At number 17, I've put Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. Now, this film has a rather odd production history, or at least it seemed like a weird choice of remake to go for, particularly for the director. This is a remake of the Abel Ferrara original film from the 1990s, directed this time by Werner Herzog. Now, if you heard my 90s podcast, you might remember that the original was very high up on my list. Here, Herzog takes a more surreal approach to the story of a drug-addicted and corrupt cop who seeks opportunities for redemption through the solving of a particular case. And this time it stars Nicolas Cage, Eva Mendes as his girlfriend, and Val Kilmer as his partner. And it has some very funny moments where Herzog appears to be giving us the point of view of iguanas and an alligator, almost as if they're the observers of the story. It's a strange film, almost completely different in tone and style to Ferrara's original. But this idea of the narrative of descent, of a corrupt cop who's descending into this self-imposed hell through drug addiction and all sorts of other addictions, is, I think, something that all film directors should be forced to do as an artistic exercise. And seeing the different approaches from Ferrara and Herzog here makes you think of what the possibilities could be for other director-actor teams to take on. At 16, I've chosen Elephant by Gus Van Sant, which is a story of a fictional high school massacre shot in a very detached style, with very little dialogue, very observational, but still manages to be quite dreamy. Interestingly, Van Sant took the title of Elephant from a British television film, an incredible British television film directed by Alan Clark in 1989 that was about the Troubles. And Clark's film is just a series of sectarian murders with no dialogue, all shot mostly shot on Steadicam through tracking shots in a very detached style. Now, Van Sant's Elephant's not a film that drags you in terms of its characters. It's deliberately detached and deliberately doesn't explain the intentions of its characters. And perhaps that's quite alienating for some people. Nevertheless, I think it's a quite fantastically made film and is a really beautiful exercise in style. Okay, so before I go any further, I want to switch now to bringing in one of my guests. And we're going to start with Dr. Chris Deasy, who is an academic at the University of Kent and also an expert on film. And he's joining me to tell me his favourite film released between 2000 and 2009. You contributed to my Best Films of the 1990s podcast. And in that one, I was a little bit naughty because I didn't let you choose the film you probably would have chosen as your number one, because it was the one that I'd earmarked for myself. In this one, I give you carte blanche. What film have you picked?
Well, the film I've chosen is Rocky Balboa. Now, this is an interesting one because you've got all the mythology around the Rocky films. And actually, my viewing of this film has a little bit of that mythology in it, because I didn't actually see it when it came out. I wanted to. But even at a film festival, was it a film festival? It was a conference in the Netherlands. And I went to that, and we all had like a free evening. We were going to go to the cinema. And I saw Rocky Burr on the list, and I thought, great, I'd love to go and see Rocky. But a few people were like, I'm just not in the mood for a film about a fighter. Sorry, it's too masculine, too much testosterone. We're not going to go for it. So there was another occasion as well, somebody I was going to go with, who was like, no, I just don't feel in the right frame of mind for a film about Rocky It's a boxing film. Maybe they had Rocky IV in mind, and that sort of fulfilled all the different stereotypes. So it was like, no, just not for me. When I finally did see the film, and it was actually in the 2000s, because of course technically then I thought, if I didn't see it in the 2000s, does it qualify for your for your competition? But I did, just in 2009 on DVD. And I was completely blown away, because I mean, my work is on nostalgia. I do stuff on death and Christmas, and obviously on film. And it kind of felt that this film had all of those elements, a very wistful film, very melancholic film. I mean, the stench of death is all over it in terms of his beloved Adrian having died. I mean, nostalgia. I mean, I think that's even referenced in a conversation with Paulie at one point. And Redemption, which was my PhD title. So it's like, I thought Scorsese was like the go-to filmmaker, but actually watching this film as well. And even Christmas, because you've got almost the sort of the ghosts of the past, the present and the future. And he's like living this life where... one full of integrity, where he's chosen not to live the life that he could have led as a champion. He's gone back to his roots. And the cinematography in the second half is so interesting, because when you actually see him in the ring, it's like you're watching a TV version. It's like watching the sports channel with all the graphics coming in. It's very fast-paced. It's very well done, but very snazzy. But how different to the very low-lit cinematography that the Philly streets and the time and precision, which is exactly what the first Rocky film was all about. So it's like a film in two halves in a way. You've got the authentic milieu of Rocky in his roots, and he's full of integrity and integral to those roots. And then you've got the brash world where he kind of has to prove something to himself, if nothing else, or maybe to Adrian. And of course, the film ends with him sitting in the cemetery and talking to Adrian, and he like almost disappears. He becomes like phosphorescent. There's a scene where the focus is on the rose on the grave, and then you see him disappearing. It's like he's gone to join her in the afterlife. But I know he shot two endings, and I have seen the alternate ending, and I wish I hadn't, because if he had released that ending, it would have been in keeping with some of the other Rocky films where he wins, rather than this one here, which, like the first Rocky in 76, he doesn't. But you know how the Rocky soundtrack was used by a lot of presidential candidates? I think Bob Dole and Hillary Clinton used it, and it was pointed out, but they, you know, Rocky didn't win, and of course Dole and Clinton didn't win. But that's not what the point is of Rocky, that he wins in a completely different sense to whether the judges decide that, you know, on a split, you know, decision or whatever, he wins or doesn't win. So I think the Rocky films kind of lost their way a bit in the 80s. I've just seen the new Rocky IV recut version, which is perhaps better than the original, but it's just a different sort of genre. And it's hard to sort of see that. I know he got rid of the robot character, which was just sort of completely in keeping with the 80s, but nothing to do with what Rocky was all about. This film is completely back to his roots. And I kind of feel here that, you know, he's waxing nostalgically. The bit that stands out, you know, when he's in the restaurant and he's going around all the different tables and he's telling them about all the different fights that he fought before. You know, this is a guy who's so true to his roots. But the film's pacing is just so clever, because if you were a stranger to some of the Rocky films, you might think, right, it's just a film about fighting and he's going to be fighting. And you're a good sort of hour in before you even get to the Vegas Stadium. So I think he's very good at wrong-footing us all the way through.
Let me ask you a question, because even though the film, I always consider the film to end proper, exactly as you say, he disappears while sitting by the graveyard.
Yeah.
It does actually end with the credits, where you've got all the people running up the up the steps, which is pure nostalgia, really, isn't it? I mean, it's almost kind of it's almost a meta sequence. You know, I don't know if you thought a little bit about that at all. The kind of then the all the people are running up the steps and they're pretending to do the kind of the cheering at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I really like that, because what that showed is in the 2006. So yeah, it was 30 years since the first Rocky film. And it showed that in that time, the film was part of our folklore. It was the national mythology, obviously, American mythology. And you had all these, and it finished, of course, with him, or the 1976 Rocky, in that same position as all the people in 2006 running up. So it showed, in a way, this guy, he's the working class hero, he's true to his roots, and they're all following in his footsteps, literally. That in a way, it's part of a movement. So actually, you're right. But in a way, that still conforms to that disappearing like a ghost thing, because in a way, he's done his bit. He's kind of, I mean, you're watching the film and you're thinking, is he going to win the contest or not? But also, and this is something that comes out in the Creed films, shows that the legend doesn't die, then you've got the question of whether he's going to die or be resurrected. So you kind of feel that whether he lives or dies as a person, the movement around him has been completely, you know, inspired and galvanized by him. So it kind of fits with the idea that the legend is there irrespective of whether the man is or is not with us anymore.
Thanks, Chris, for that contribution. And I just want to point out to listeners that Chris Deasy does his own podcast called The Nostalgia Podcast, which is really great and got really in-depth interviews with lots of interesting people. So please go and check that out. At number 15 on my list, I've chosen The Notorious Betty Page, directed by Mary Harron. Now, this is a portrait, a biographical portrait of Betty Page, the famous burlesque star, perhaps the most famous burlesque star of all time. If you're interested in Americana and American pop history, this is a film you should really check out. There's an innocence to The Notorious Betty Page, despite the fact that it's based around the emergence of pornography and erotica as a media form, that is really quite endearing. At 14, I've gone for Battle Royale, the highly popular Japanese film about school kids forced to fight to the death on an island as an example to a deteriorating society. Very funny, very subversive film. My favourite characters are the ones who have volunteered to go back onto the island and play the game again. They've previously survived it. And it's got lots of great images of teenage school children being stabbed and shot and blown up. And it's one of those films that makes you wonder about what your strategy would be if you're in the same situation. Would you make alliances with other people? Would you hide there until there was only a couple of people left that you could kill? Would you try and escape? Not sure how I would play it. A lot of it depends on what weapons you were able to get hold of. Some people are given guns, some people are given grenades. One poor bloke, from what I remember, is given a fan. So, you know, it all depends. At number 13, I've chosen Land of the Dead by George Romero. Now, what I really like about Land of the Dead, this was a sequel that came out about 18 years after the previous Dead film, Day of the Dead, which is probably my favourite of that series. And what I like about it was his comic book style that he employs in Land of the Dead. Now, since Day of the Dead and his original trilogy, there have been a lot of academic pieces written about the politics of Romero's zombie films and how they're important critiques of consumerist culture and critiques of American military involvement in other countries or civil rights, etc., etc., etc. But Romero, who would have known about all of that, resists making Land of the Dead too pretentious. And not that I have a problem with pretentious films necessarily, but what I like is that Romero didn't try to overplay the mythology of his universe or consider himself beyond the genre of horror. Now, Land of the Dead has a clear political allegory. There are rich people living in a high-rise block with money and shops to buy things from and living in luxury. There's a class of people outside that high-rise block who work for them and provide them with goods and go out battling the zombies to try and loot any resources that they can still find. And then beyond that, you've got a kind of underclass of zombies, right, who are tired of being exploited. That's the political allegory. It doesn't stop the film really being mostly a zombie battle throughout, right? There's lots of gore, lots of shooting, lots of action. And it's probably the last great film that Romero made. There were two other Dead films after this, Diary of the Dead and Survivor of the Dead, both of which, you know, struggle to work, in my opinion. So 13, Land of the Dead. At number 12, I've gone for Tape, directed by Richard Linklater. Now, what I like about this film is it's an adaptation of a play. It's all set in one room and has three cast members, including Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman. Now, I return to this film every few years, and I always enjoy it when I do. I really love the fact that he shot it on mini DV. Now, I love the mini DV format. I think we've lost something in its demise, it's been replaced by HD, it's been replaced by other high-end video formats, and it's rather sad to look at something like Tape, shot on mini DV and think nothing like that will ever get made again. And the video style and cinematography and the quality of image that you get really locates the film in a specific space of time for those 10 or so years when mini DV was the go-to format for no-budget filmmakers. On top of that, it's got some great acting. It's a great story in and of itself. I recommend you watching it if you haven't seen it. So, at 12, Richard Linklater's Tape. At 11, I've chosen Kill Bill Volume 1. Now, the basement scene from Inglourious Basterds in 2009, the same decade, does contain what might be Quentin Tarantino's best ever sequence. And probably would have made a fantastic short film in and of itself. And I don't think anything in Kill Bill Volume 1 really lives up to that. But as a whole movie, it's a far quicker and lighter piece, more generally, than Inglourious Basterds. Although, of course, originally it was made as one whole film with Kill Bill Volume 2, and then it was cut down into different parts, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And Volume 2 really struggles to work. It's very wordy. I remember when I saw that at the cinema, the audience were groaning all the way through the last 40 minutes and really wasn't worth waiting for. Although there's pleasure to be had in Kill Bill Volume 2 now when you look back at it. But nevertheless, Kill Bill Volume 1 is a superb action film. It's a lot of fun, very stylish, and made a real change from the kind of films that Tarantino was making before that. So this comes after Jackie Brown, and it switches from Tarantino making those hangout films, those kind of almost lo-fi dialogue-led pieces, into the flashy pastiches of genre films that he made subsequently. So the Kill Bill films, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, etc., etc. And you could say that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a bringing together of both of those styles. At number 10, I've chosen my second Mary Harron film, American Psycho. Now, we can discuss the relative merits of this or the Bret Easton novel on which it's based, but it works as a companion piece to the novel for me. And it illuminates and adapts some of the most famous scenes of the book, and does it very well. Now, like Notorious Betty Page, Mary Harron leaves out the more gruesome elements of the story. For those who've read the novel, there's long passages of very extreme violence and descriptions of violence. And it's a very descriptive novel generally. Now, I'm not sure how much American Psycho is remembered with affection. Whenever I hear or see anything to do with American Psycho now, it seems to be through memes and GIFs on social media. So maybe some of the satire of Harron's adaptation of American Psycho is overplayed. And I would argue you probably need the extreme violence to balance it out a little bit, to avoid what could be thought of as smugness. But that's looking back and being critical in retrospect. Because I was a big fan of Bret Easton Ellis at the time, I was a big fan of the book, and I was a big fan of the film, and I'm very comfortable placing it at number 10. At number 9, I've chosen Match Point by Woody Allen. Now, this is my favourite Woody Allen film since Husbands and Wives, and one of his best, all told. It revisits some of the same thematic ground of Crimes and Misdemeanors that he made in the 80s. And what's great as a British person is watching lots of actors familiar from British TV crop up in minor cameos. Mark Gatiss from The League of Gentlemen pops up as a table tennis player and he doesn't even say a word. Steve Pemberton, also from League of Gentlemen, plays a cop who's got some bizarre dialogue. And you wonder whether Woody Allen knew who any of them were. Most bizarrely of all is a cameo by Paul Kaye as an estate agent. Now, Paul Kaye used to adopt this persona of someone he called Dennis Penis, who used to go around bothering celebs as they came out of hotels and clubs in the 1990s. And he was a popular comic character for a while. And at one point, during one of his videos, he interrupts Woody Allen in the street in one of his skits. The Dennis Penis demeanour was based on Woody Allen in part. It was like a mix of Woody Allen and Johnny Rotten. And it would be interesting to know whether Woody Allen remembered Paul Kaye doing this to him several years earlier, or whether it was even brought up on set at all, or whether Paul Kaye kept it to himself and thought it was best not to mention it. At number 8, I've gone for The Damned United. Now, this is one of the most fun films on this list, and I can watch it pretty much at any time. It's set in the 1970s, and it recreates the 70s football period brilliantly, which mustn't have been a very easy task, given the fact most of the old stadiums and the old streets had been knocked down. And I'd argue this is one of the best, if not the best, football films ever made. It stars Michael Sheen as Brian Clough, another one of Sheen's brilliant impersonations of an iconic British popular figure. And it's all about how Clough both succeeded at Derby County, but also failed as manager of Leeds United, quite famously. And I know certain people close to Clough weren't happy with the film, that they thought it was very derogatory or even defamatory against him. And I know that the film itself is a lot more jovial than the David Peace novel that it's based on, but I don't care. I think it's a great tribute to Brian Clough as a man and a manager, and a very underrated movie. Right, let's bring in the second of my guests. This time I've got Dr. Jennifer Wallace, who's a historian of medicine and psychiatry, but who is also an expert in cult cinema. And she's joining me to give me her favourite film of the decade.
If I'd been asked to pick my favourite film from an earlier decade, I would probably have chosen John Carpenter's The Fog. But I promise that I have not picked 2007's The Mist simply because I really like weather-related horror films. So The Mist is an adaptation of the short story of the same name by Stephen King, first published in 1980 in an anthology. And the film is directed by Frank Darabont, who also directed The Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile, both adaptations of King's work. The film focuses on a group of people who are trapped in a small town supermarket by an unearthly mist. And as the film progresses, it's revealed that this mist contains all sorts of monstrous creatures that have been set free in some kind of accident at the local army base, where researchers have opened a window onto some other kind of Lovecraftian dimension. It's not a very subtle film, and all the best tropes are in there. The horror in a small town, the secret military research taking place on the outskirts. It's very easy, I think, to picture it all as a story in an EC comic, especially with moments like a giant tentacle that rears up with a sack of dog food that bursts and showers everybody with biscuits. There's hardly any backstory. We're pitched straight into the crisis, and the mist itself appears within the first few minutes. We have air raid sirens going off and someone running into the supermarket screaming that there's something in the mist. There are also some fantastic characters in this film, from the very sinister Mrs. Carmody, who, as another character says in the film, she is disturbingly Jim Jones-ish. And there is also a domineering older lady, Irene, who sets fire to this giant, gnashing, spidery thing with a lighter and an aerosol. And I absolutely adore the fact that Toby Jones plays this unlikely hero in a cardigan who's the only one who can shoot the gun properly. Of course, I think it's the supermarket setting that makes the film. It's the modern dystopia and refuge, and it constitutes this strange little marooned island of the familiar in the middle of this mist. And pretty quickly, we realise that there is as much of a threat from the people inside the supermarket as from the otherworldly creatures that are outside it. So there are two horrors in the mist, one human and one inhuman. And like the best horror films, I think, it's the human one that you end up feeling more terrified by. I think when you watch it, you can't avoid considering which side you'd be on in the same situation. Are you going to be part of this cultish congregation led by Mrs. Carmody who are hoping to be saved? Or are you in this smaller band of more realistic rebels? And I think I'd rather be eaten by a 50-foot-high monster than be stabbed to death by a group of religious evangelists in the cereal aisle. And I won't give it away completely, But this film also has one of the most undeniably bleak endings that I've ever seen in a film, which unfolds in this rather odd dreamlike sequence. The first time I watched this film, I remember exclaiming out loud at the ending, and it was apparently such a point of contention that Darabont had the studio agree in advance that they wouldn't actually alter the ending. And I don't know what this says about me, but The End of the Mist is the same reason that I love Fulci's Zombie. No one wins and the outlook is fairly hopeless. But there's a really nice ambient soundtrack while the world's falling apart.
Thanks, Jennifer, for that contribution. I'll have to rewatch The Mist based on that recommendation. And if you're interested in more of Jennifer's writing, you can search for her online, but also go to Head Press Books, which publishes loads of excellent court film material. And Jennifer does some blogs on that website too. Thanks again, Jennifer. At 7, I've gone for Zatoichi, directed by and starring Takeshi Kitano as the blind swordsman of the title, who is an iconic character from 70s Japanese cinema. Now, this is a very interesting film that shifts through different genres. It's a samurai movie, so it's got lots of action and swordplay. But as you might expect from Takeshi Kitano, who directed great movies like Boiling Point, Violent Cop and Sonatine in the 1990s, there are also moments of quite silly slapstick comedy. And this is built out of Kitano's background in comedy and comedy television. But he also brings in a couple of musical sequences as well, which are really interesting. And I hate the expression offbeat or off-kilter, but it's a really offbeat and off-kilter variation on the samurai legend. Now, what makes this film great is the characters. You've got this old lady who is a bone setter. You've got a couple of geisha girls, one of whom is actually a boy in drag. And one of the villains is a very noble character, actually, who only gets involved with the bad guys to pay for his wife's healthcare. So Kitano does everything he can to avoid cliche. My only complaint about Zatoichi is that the blood is in CGI. It's one of those stylistic things that really dates the movie as being a film from the noughties. At 6, I've gone for the Gaspar Noé movie, Irreversible. Now, if you've seen Irreversible, you'll know what an incredible movie that it really is. And that is unarguable, even if you have no desire to watch the film again. It's so high on my list because its effect on the viewer and audience, I think, is just undeniable. For those who haven't seen it, the entire narrative takes place backwards. Each sequence is shot in long takes, long single takes, and the camera work is constantly roving, constantly moving. And the soundtrack accompanies this by throbbing and droning and really getting under the skin. So formally, it's a very special film. And I would say it's as formally impressive as something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which tries to merge the sound and the image as a method by which to unnerve the viewer. So it's not just what's happening in the film, it's how it's happening. And overall, the effect is quite undeniably depressing, but it's brilliant filmmaking all the same. At 5, I've chosen Inland Empire. Now, this is amazingly the last feature film that David Lynch has made, though he has been busy ever since with things like Twin Peaks and various other projects. Inland Empire is shot on digital video. It's nearly 3 hours long and a very rambling piece of work that originally I just didn't take to. In fact, it took me years to finish it. But it's got a really distinct atmosphere that just kept drawing me back. And it wasn't until probably a full 10 years after it was released that I finally finished it. And it suddenly struck me. It hit a chord and then I loved it. And now I'd say it's my favourite David Lynch film. I love the video aesthetic, shot on mini DV. As I said with Taper by Richard Linklater, it's a real shame that this format has died. I love Laura Dern's performance, obviously, and I really like the labyrinth-style unfolding of the story. Does it make sense? Well, who cares, really? Who said that films are supposed to make sense? People who want films to make sense don't deserve to watch films in the first place. I remember Jonathan Ross reviewing Inland Empire on the film programme on the BBC, at the time, where he concluded, and I'm quoting, "Inland Empire is a masterpiece, I think," end quote. It's a very funny statement to make, but personally, I have fewer qualms about claiming it to be a masterpiece. So, Inland Empire at number 5. At number 4, it's one of the most entertaining films of all time. It's the Australian movie Chopper, directed by Andrew Dominik, based on Mark Brandon Reed's testimony of his life in crime. Now, this is a very funny film that's perhaps the most extreme embodiment of the Australian ochre archetype. Now, what's really interesting is the way the film plays with the idea of memory and mythologising and self-mythologising, especially during its second half, where you're not quite sure if what Reed's character is telling you happened, actually happened. Did he really kill this man in the way that he's explained it? Did he really kill this man at all? Andrew Dominik got a lot of attention for directing The Assassination of Jesse James, and that film does similar things with the idea of the outlaw mythology, of how the mythology can be told by various different people and people writing their own stories and placing themselves into popular culture. But I don't think The Assassination of Jesse James is anywhere near as good or as enjoyable as Chopper. If you do revisit this film, or if you've not seen it, try and watch it with Mark Reed's commentary on the DVD if you get the chance. So at number 3, I've chosen The Passion of the Christ, directed by Mel Gibson. A remarkable, truly remarkable piece of work, structured around the 14 stations of the cross from Jesus' sentence to crucifixion, but which also includes the scourging of Jesus at the pillar in what is just a relentlessly violent scene that seemed to go on forever, and which I remember caused some people in the audience to start crying in the cinema when I first saw it. The Passion of the Christ is full of really striking imagery, and like Irreversible or Fahrenheit 9/11, regardless of your personal feelings about the content, if you're a fan of films or if you're a fan of art in general, you have to appreciate the value of what is being created here. Passion of the Christ is a masterpiece, even if you don't happen to like it. And it aims for a pure sensory overload. And people said at the time that this was the crucifixion story as a horror movie. And you can see why people would say that. It's one of the most kind of devotional films of all time, I think, and the most sincere. And number 2, I've chosen The Rules of Attraction, directed by Roger Avery. Now, this is the second Bret Easton Ellis adaptation that I've included here, and what I think is the best adaptation of his books. The book is told from multiple different characters' perspectives. Roger Avery does a great job of weaving in the different narrative threads, even if the love triangle, or sex triangle more accurately, I should say, of the book is only really touched on briefly. Again, like American Psycho, it's that companion piece. You can't really compare it to the novel. You have to watch them both together to get the full appreciation. There are lots of great sequences here. The suicide scene stands out. First meeting between the character of Lauren and the character of Sean Bateman, who is the brother of Patrick Bateman from American Psycho, incidentally, is really terrific. It's got Donovan on the soundtrack and it's shot in split screen. But the most flashy sequence is the character of Victor's trip to Europe, which is crammed into 5 minutes, but was comprised out of over 70 hours worth of material captured during the actor's real trip to Europe, which was, again, shot on mini DV, this great format that keeps cropping up in my list, but which is now dead. Now, this material, this 70 hours worth of footage, was also cut into a feature film called Glitterati, which remains one of the great unreleased films. It's unreleased for numerous reasons, but it's supposed to involve the actor Kip Pardew in character as Victor, interacting with members of the public in bars and clubs. A shame that none of us will ever get to see this film, but it also might be for the best, since it's essentially a home movie and its own director has called it ethically questionable. But that's by the by. Rules of Attraction, in and of itself, is a real underrated film from the decade. At number 1, I've chosen a documentary by Philip Groening called Into Great Silence. And this is a documentary about Carthusian monks living in the Grand Chartreuse Monastery in the French Alps. Forgive me if I've pronounced that incorrectly. I only came to this film relatively recently, but it's got this amazing production history that took over 20 years from the initial proposal to its eventual release. And what happened was Philip Groening wrote to the Carthusian monks of the monastery to ask if he could film there, but didn't hear back from them for a full 16 years before they finally granted him permission. And he was eventually went and stayed with them for 6 months on his own and made the film completely solo. And this result is an incredible 2.5 hour virtually silent observational documentary about the Carthusian monks of Grand Chartres. It's another film, the third on the list, shot on mini DV using the Sony HDW F900. And because it's shot entirely with natural light, it's got lots of that accompanying digital grain. Though Groening also weaves in some time-lapse cinematography and I think some Super 8. That it's all shot on available light is accompanied by the soundtrack, which is all recorded on location. None of it's added afterwards. And Groening pretty much did everything. He shot the film, he edited it, he produced it, he directed it all himself. The long stretches of silence in this film become almost meditative. And I know that sounds like a cliche. Again, maybe like The Passion of the Christ, there's a devotional element to this. The film's length and stillness is a necessary part of its message. There's a video art feel to the films at times. It could well have worked as an installation in a gallery. It's a masterpiece in that form and content align completely. And if you watch any other media about monastery life, including on TV or short films on the web, parts of that still meditative style are replicated. But Groening, he doesn't just include long takes. Instead, the cutting, the editing is relatively frequent so that there is a real rhythm to the structure of the movie. There are some truly beautiful shots, which is hard not to capture, given how incredible the location is in the snowy mountains. And there's a particular focus of Groening's camera on light being refracted and reflected through windows. This is a hard film to get hold of. There is a version on YouTube that you can find. I have an old copy on DVD, and you can probably get it second hand, although you might have to pay over the typical price. If you've not seen it, Into Great Silence is a hard film to describe the power of. And it really has to be seen, and I would say experienced. And because of its remarkable production history, and that it feels like a genuinely unique piece of cinema, created almost entirely by the hands of one man, I proclaim Into Great Silence as the best film of the decade between 2000 and 2009. So, there we are. Thanks to Dr. Chris Deasy and Dr. Jennifer Wallace for joining me to give me their nominations. And thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.